This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
There's no afterlife, but there sure is a lot to do making this world heavenly, don't you think? I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist of the airwaves. This is the weekend of May the 21st, 2011, and Free Thought Radio broadcasts and tapes. We're here in the studio with our producer and engineer, Brian Terrani, in Madison, Wisconsin. The show also airs in Atlanta, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Monterey, New York City, and podcasts all over the universe.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is a membership organization made up of atheists and agnostics and skeptics and whatever you like to call yourself. We all disbelieve in the same God.
Non-believers.
We have about 16,500 members in every state, I think every province in North America, and we work as a watchdog to keep religion out of government.
On today's show, we have two guests. We'll be talking with an 18-year-old secular student activist from South Carolina about how he has stopped graduation prayers with a little help from the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And then we'll talk with journalist Janet Heimlich, who has worked for NPR, whose new book, Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment, debuts early in June.
Before we talk with our guests, speaking of making this life our paradise, as Annie Laurie said when she started the show, we want to briefly comment on something that was in the news this past week.
We'd like to read the comments of the great British cosmologist and author Stephen Hawking, as told to The Guardian newspaper last week. And I just love the headline in The Guardian. It was, Stephen Hawking, there is no heaven. It's a fairy tale.
Stephen Hawking is 69. He's had ALS since he was 21 years old. He pointed out in his 2010 book, The Grand Design, that there's no need for a creator to explain the existence of the universe. He had previously, earlier, used the word God, but only as a metaphor. In his best-selling 1988 book, A Brief History of Time, he had said that if scientists developed a theory of everything, that it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God. Well, he said that was a metaphor, and in a later book, he regretted putting that phrase, mind of God, in there because it was metaphorical. And he asked his American publisher not to put that phrase in the book, but the publisher said, hey, if we take that word God out of the book, we'll cut the sales in half. Well, now Stephen Hawking is skipping the metaphors, and here's what he told The Guardian. I have lived with the prospect of an early death for the last 49 years. I'm not afraid of death, but I'm in no hurry to die. I have so much I want to do first. I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That's a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. He said he rejects the notion of life beyond death, and he emphasizes the need to fulfill our potential on Earth by making good use of our lives. When he was asked how we should live, Hawking replied, we should seek the greatest value of our action.
Hear, hear. My mother has always said that people can speculate endlessly about the non-existent, and I was privy to that. There's some evidence for that when I was a guest this week on a BBC radio program that was airing in Africa, but for some reason they had all American guests except for some African children, and we had religious guests except for me, and they all spun these tales just making stuff up about what heaven was. No evidence, you know, sort of ridiculous.
So what did you say on that show?
I said that we shouldn't believe in things if they're not true, that there is no evidence for, that we should place our best energies in this world, and that the only afterlife that we should be concerned about is leaving a secure and pleasant future for our descendants.
Did you say that before or after Hawking?
What do you mean?
You were commenting, you're paralleling what Hawking said.
Well, we were on the BBC program to talk about Hawking.
Oh, you were? Okay.
But I have made that comment in the past.
Okay.
Madison Magazine has even quoted me way back.
So he's stealing, he's borrowing from
right.
you.
And while no, he's not. I'm very proud that we're in the same camp as Stephen Hawking. And I also said on this program on BBC, I thought it was very poignant and something very truthful about a man like Stephen Hawking, with all that he has had to live with his disability, refusing to comfort himself with lies and fairy tales. So he's facing life squarely. We should all do it and make the best of our time here.
Here, 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 here. Coming up, our first guest is Harrison Hopkins. He's a very brave high school senior in South Carolina whose complaint has stopped a tradition of commencement prayers. At least we hope that's what's happening.
And we're going to go out of this segment with an excerpt of Dan's song for children. It's called No Hurry to Die, in honor of Stephen Hawking, who used that exact phrase in his Guardian interview.
Don't want to end up on somebody's plate. Don't want to be what a cannibal ate. I want to live to 108. I'm in no hurry to die. I'm in no hurry to fall over dead. I'd rather fall over laughing instead. I have a whole lot of living ahead. I'm in no hurry to die.
I'm Dan Barker. I'm here with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and Free Thought Radio will be right back.
Hi, my name is Candace Lang from Atlanta, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
Faith is believing what you know ain't so. I'm Dan Barker.
And I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And welcome back to Free Thought Radio. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. You can join us. You can become a member. Go to ffrf.org and sign up. And even if you don't join, take a moment to create your very own out-of-the-closet message as part of our virtual billboard campaign at ffrf.org/out. It's really fun. It's really cool. And we will look for your face, your name, and your message soon at our website.
On the phone with us in between his classes and some after-school activities is Harrison Hopkins. Harrison is a senior at Lawrence District High School, and he tells us his interests include computers and the internet, marksmanship, and as of recently, activism, and he is an atheist. And we first heard from Harrison in April when he contacted our office seeking assistance because public officials at his school in Lawrence, South Carolina, were scheduling a vote by his senior class on whether to have an invocation at the upcoming graduation on June 2nd. And apparently this kind of vote is typical. There's typically been a commencement prayer. And of course, that's illegal, both student-led or student-initiated prayer commencements or school events. And so Harrison, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you all for having me on.
And can you tell us how you found out about this, why you became concerned about it?
Well, last year was when I first moved to the school. I used to live in North Carolina. And last year I came to live with my dad, and I started coming to Lawrence High School. And near the end of last school year, I started hearing people talk about them having a vote on whether or not to have prayer at the graduation ceremony. And at the time, I thought, well, that doesn't exactly sound legal to me. And this year, I started doing research because it was becoming time for our vote, and I found many things that pointed that it was, in fact, illegal. So.
And did I'm a little fuzzy about the details. Did they didn't actually have the vote. Did they call it off?
This year they did not have the vote. No, it was called off.
Rebecca wrote, what, three different letters?
Right. There was the first one that said, that went through and gave cases that showed that it was illegal. And before the day of the thing, before the day of the when the vote was scheduled, apparently the Freedom From Religion Foundation hadn't heard a response, so she sent another letter to them about it. And then at the meeting at which the vote was supposed to be held, the vote wasn't held, but a packet was given out to us that mentioned graduation is not over until after the prayer and recessional. Hmm. So once I contacted you guys with a copy of that, she wrote another letter to the school asking for verification that there was indeed not going to be a school-sponsored prayer at the ceremony.
Yeah, we're talking about our senior staff attorney, Rebecca Markert, and so we have a little victory, we hope. But why don't we, before we talk some more about what all this has meant for you, because it's a huge issue where you live, let's play some of the TV coverage and audio of some of the TV coverage that, and you're included in that.
I'm upset about it.
Lawrence District 55 high school senior Austin Paysinger is hoping prayer will get back into his high school graduation ceremony.
I say majority rules. They don't want to pray, they don't have to stand up and pray. It's only a few minute prayer. I mean, if they don't have to listen.
Harrison Hopkins is an atheist. He says he's not against religion. He just doesn't feel it should be at graduation.
It gives the feeling to us that aren't of that certain religion that we're excluded, like we're not as important as the other.
Hopkins contacted the Freedom From Religion Foundation. They say the Supreme Court has ruled that prayer cannot be used during a commencement ceremony. As a result, the school district will not have a prayer as part of the graduation ceremony. In a statement, Superintendent Billy Strickland explains why. Our legal counsel has advised us that we should discontinue the practice of voting on whether to have an invocation delivered at the graduation ceremony so we do not create a basis for a legal challenge. That being said, prayer is still a possibility. He goes on to say, the views expressed during the student-led messages are solely those of the speaker and do not reflect the approval or disapproval of Lawrence School District 55 or the school administration.
What's going to be your reaction if someone brings up in their speech a little prayer?
That would be okay, because that is not supported by the school. That is the student doing it of their own accord, and that is well within their First Amendment rights.
So you just heard Harrison Hopkins being interviewed by one of his local TV stations. We have Harrison on the phone with us. The graduation isn't set for a few more weeks. Can you tell us what's been going on since the news came down that the vote was suspended and the school wouldn't be promoting prayer?
People are pretty, I don't know if angry or upset it would fit the description more. There have been all kinds of posts, like on Facebook, from people saying, I don't understand why we can't have a prayer, or who does this kid think he is?
So they know you, you're public now, and they know who you are?
Right, after that newscast went out, they realized who I was. So.
And some of them were kind of veiled threats, weren't they?
There was one guy who said, it was along the lines of, this kid will be sorry what happens. We have something up our sleeves. He won't get his way in the end.
Ooh, that sounds scary.
And it wasn't there also something about the Lord's Prayer being said en masse?
Well, there are a bunch of plans for the day of graduation. People from the community are trying to organize a prayer chain to go along the fence outside of the school the day of, and also students are saying that at the end of graduation they're all going to stand up, and recite the Lord's Prayer.
Now, does the school know about this?
I can't imagine how they wouldn't know, but they have not mentioned anything about it. So,
well, we're looking into the legalities of all this and what we can do to help you, but in terms of, at school, what's the atmosphere like? Are you being harassed? Are people saying anything to you in class, or everything normal?
Well, people are not saying anything to me directly, but as I walk through, like, Commons during lunch, Commons is the name of our lunchroom. when I walk through there, I can notice everybody staring at me and people whispering things such as, oh, there he is, or look, that's the guy, and things like that. So
well, that,
they are.
That's kind of hard on you. Do you have any friends in the school who are and people who are standing up to support you?
I have quite a few people, actually. My best friend has been very vocal in her support of me. And one of the higher-ranked people of next year's graduating class has also said that she's in support of me as well.
Now, if
and
you...
Also,
I'm sorry.
I've also had just people come up to me randomly and say, hey, I'm atheist, I agree with what you're doing, or I'm Christian and I agree with what you're doing. And
now, if you had... This is a podium. Just imagine you're explaining to the students who don't get it why you came forward, why it's wrong to have prayer at graduation.
Put simply, it's against the First Amendment. Our country was founded on the secularity of our government, and if the school supports or endorses a prayer, it is in violation of that, and that's just in violation of everything that our country was founded upon.
And you, as a non-believer, of course, are going to feel sensitive to the fact that the majority likes to flex its muscles in the, you know, in their graduation. So, you know, these students that are saying that they want to recite the Lord's Prayer or make like a protest, what if the school got wind of you and some atheists and agnostics deciding, hey, we're going to stand up and chant, there is no God? Would they just, would they leave you alone, or would they caution you?
I don't know what would happen. Like I said, the administration hasn't really said that there's not going to be a prayer. They've just said we will cancel the vote and won't schedule a prayer.
Yeah, it's kind of a wink and a nod, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like they're saying, oh, we're not going to say you can't, and we're not going to admit that we've been wrong.
But they're hoping, they know that a lot of the students are going to take it on themselves to go ahead and do that.
Right, and I can't imagine them being too happy if, like you said, me and some other atheists stood up and started saying there is no God, or if I had been, like, let's say I was one of the speakers, if I had decided to include in my speech that, hey, there's no God in your life or anything like that, I'm sure they would not have been too happy.
I was not suggesting that you do that, by the way.
I know.
I mean, it has to come from you.
What's wrong with this picture, though, is that this school... And this school district for years and years has been violating very clear Supreme Court decisions saying you can't have graduation prayer, you can't schedule votes, you can't have student-initiated prayer. And because of this wrongdoing by the school, the students are now getting the direction from the school officials, let's go ahead and have a rogue prayer. So that's what troubles me the most. Now, Harrison, are you a kind of lifelong atheist, or is this something you've come to recently?
Honestly, I think it has been a lifelong thing. I've been asked this question several times in a few of my interviews, actually, but I can't remember a time throughout my life that I ever actually deeply believed that there was a God. I mean, when I was younger, I would go to church on Wednesdays, go to Sunday school, but like that was just more of a social thing because I would go with my friends. I can't really say that I ever actually believed that there was a God somewhere. So at the very least, I've been a doubter all of my life, but it took me until 7th or 8th grade to find out what an atheist was, and that's when I realized, hey, this is me. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in a God.
And is your family religious, and are you the only one in your family who has rejected religion, or were they non-religious?
My dad is... What is that?
Go ahead. The music is signaling we're about ready to end, but you got a second there to reply.
Okay, my dad is agnostic. He doesn't really care, and like my mother's side of the family is very religious, and they don't know about this yet.
Well, Harrison, we salute you for speaking up, and we'll be in touch about what's happening, and thank you so much for caring about the Constitution and caring about the law at your high school, and we'll keep people posted on what happens.
And coming up, we're talking with, who is it, Janet Heimlich?
We are going to be talking with a journalist about religious malpractice used against children, child abuse in the name of religion. And we have just been speaking with student activist Harrison Heimlich.
Hopkins,
and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Hank Zumach from La Crosse, Wisconsin area, and the more of us that stand up and come out of the closet, the more of us will in the future.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker with Free Thought Radio. And that's some of the background music from the online video at the website of our guest today. Our next guest is the journalist Janet Heimlich. Janet Heimlich received a BA in communications from Stanford, after which she began a long career of producing and writing corporate commercial film and video presentations in California. For 8 years, Ms. Heimlich freelanced as a reporter for National Public Radio. She won 9 journalism awards, including the prestigious Katie, given by the Press Club of Dallas, the Houston Press Club's Radio Journalist of the Year, and Texas Bar Association's Gavel Award. She's also written many nonfiction articles for publications such as Texas Monthly, the Austin American Statesman, and the Texas Observer. She's exposed the injustices of capital punishment and in our prison systems. Her newest book, just released, is called Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. It's the first book to take an in-depth look at child abuse and neglect caused by religious belief. So welcome to Free Thought Radio, and congratulations on your upcoming book, Janet.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So could you tell us what some of the catalysts were that got you researching and deciding to write a book on this topic?
Sure. Both personal and professional, I would say. I became a mother rather late in life, at the age of 41, and it was really only then that I became more attuned to child parenting issues. I had enrolled my daughter in a Montessori school and started to learn a little bit more about compassionate parenting. So it was from that framework I started to ask friends of mine just how they were raised, and learned that many people I knew were raised with a lot more religion than I was. I say in my book that I really was raised with hardly any faith at all. I call it watered-down Judaism. We had a Christmas tree in our living room every year. And
that is watered-down Judaism.
so it was sort of there. We knew it was there, but there was really no discussion about faith at all. And I guess I just sort of, all these things culminated, and there were also news stories that I began collecting. This was pretty much on the heels of when the Catholic child sexual abuse scandal became widely known. And during 1 week, the Pope came to the United States for the first time to acknowledge child sexual abuse in the institution. And that same week, there was a massive raid on West Texas fundamentalist Mormon sect, where hundreds of children were removed based on concerns of child abuse. So, and all of this snowballed, and I did also come across a very severe case where a toddler had died in a Baltimore cult. I felt like this book needs to be written.
So the book is called Breaking Their Will. That's a chilling title. And obviously the point of your book is not to lead people away from religion or to embrace your non-religious views, but in the book you do have to rebut some of the cliches or some of the myths about religion and its treatment of children. What are some of the assumptions and misconceptions about religion and about the Bible pertaining to children and children's rights?
I do want to say that I really make clear that this is not a book that bashes all religion. From the get-go, I acknowledge that, and this is based on interviews I had with many people and, of course, much writing that I've read, that raising a child in faith can be a great experience for that child. And some of people, friends of mine, have attested to that. And so that's not a place where I'm coming from. But what I do want to do is differentiate between unhealthy faith for a child and healthy faith. There is this preconception, I think, and this idea that many Americans are raised with, that all religion is great and it could never lead to anything terrible, especially something as terrible as child maltreatment. And I use the term maltreatment because that includes both abuse and neglect. So my first major point in the book is to just say, let's come from a place of reason, where we can admit that religion can both help children, but it can also harm them. And
well,
so,
like corporal really punishment in the Bible, right, where the Bible says you should strike the child?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you talk to most people of faith, certainly conservative Christians, they're going to say that, oh, the Bible just says wonderful things about children, and Jesus loved children, and so forth. But if you really take a look at the text, you will see that there's very, very little in the Bible that really talks about children being important people. And much of what it does say about children has to do with violence against them. For example, as you point out in Proverbs, there's repeated passages that tell parents to use, quote, the rod on children, or raise children with authoritarian parenting styles. But in addition to that, I mean, if you take the Ten Commandments, you'll notice that the word children is used only once, and it's not in a flattering way. And then there are also many, many stories in the Bible that talk about children as victims of violence, and some of that is perpetrated, supposedly, by God.
So how do these biblical injunctions get in the way? How do they create the problems that you are documenting in your book?
Well, I think that if we're dealing with reasonable people of faith, they're not going to take these kind of passages and have it justify abuse. But where I do have big concerns is with very conservative believers, orthodox, fundamentalist, extremist believers who feel obligated, whether it's because they were raised that way or because they are just wired that way psychologically, that they will feel obligated to harm children because they feel that it is righteous, that it is somehow sanctioned by God or somehow mandated by their faith.
Well, could you talk a little bit about that heinous case, which I remember, in Baltimore? Tell our listeners what happened.
Well, this was a one-house cult of just a handful of people, but it also included children in addition to those adults. And there was a toddler who was one of those children. He was not saying amen at mealtimes. He was a toddler.
Right.
So his mastery of English probably wasn't all that great anyway. But the head of this group, a woman named Queen Antoinette, apparently was infuriated by this, and she ordered everyone in the group to stop feeding the child. He was put in a room and not given food or water, and as a result, he starved to death. What is even more shocking is that one of the adults who was implicated in this case was the boy's mother. And I have talked to the dead boy's grandmother, who's just been, you know, devastated by this. But what's important to look at here is that you can have, you know, a lot of people think that, well, these crimes might just be committed by people who are crazy or just terribly sadistic. But oftentimes there are a number of perpetrators who act together, and the social dynamics, the psychological dynamics have to be better understood, because here you had a number of people who all contributed to this boy's death.
Because if that mother disagreed with the cult, she would be betraying her religion and her culture, and she had to make a martyr of her own son to test her own faith then.
Exactly. She was essentially powerless just based on the social hierarchy of the group and the belief system of the group. And this was a for lack of a better term, I mean, this was a Christian-based cult. This was not some sort of, voodoo-related thing that came from some other country. And I think that's got to be understood, that a majority of the cases that I looked at were Christian-based. And it's not because Christianity necessarily lends itself more to child abuse than other faiths. It's just that this country has more Christians in it than others. And I think you would see that same type of proportion play out in other countries if, if they had more Muslims, for example, you would see more crimes that were Islam-related, and the same in other countries if it had another type of population.
Well, okay, but I would say that either the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the Christian Bible, the Quran, these are all behavioral grab bags. And so if somebody is a true believer, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. That's the danger of literal belief in a holy book, isn't it?
Exactly, especially when you consider that these books were written centuries ago when children had way fewer rights than they even have now. So if people cannot come to grips with the idea that these books were written by people that were not as enlightened as we are, and certainly we have a lot of problems still today, then you're dealing with people who are treating children in a way that can be quite cruel.
I am Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker. We are speaking with journalist Janet Heimlich, who has a book coming out in early June, I believe. Is that right, Janet?
That's right. It should be out around June 1st.
And it's called Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Maltreatment. How can people order the book now? Who's the publisher?
The publisher is Prometheus Books, and it can be pre-ordered on Amazon. And it will be available on ebook, in a few weeks.
So we will be right back to conclude our conversation, learn more about religious maltreatment in the name of religion, and we'll be right back.
I'm Michael Newdow, and this is Free Thought Radio.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. And welcome back to the final segment of Free Thought Radio. We've been talking with the journalist and the author, Janet Heimlich, about what happens when religion is misused to break the will of children. Her book is called Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. It takes an in-depth look at child abuse and neglect caused by religious belief.
I thought it would be fun to hone in on the title of your book, Breaking Their Will. Why did you call the book that? And is that sort of at the heart of this abuse?
Right. Well, breaking their will is actually a it used to be a very commonly used term among conservative Protestants who found it necessary to break the will of children, both emotionally and physically, in order to essentially allow them eternal salvation. So you will read in many conservative Christian parenting books, some that are in print today, some that are on websites today, that talk about the concept of breaking the child's will. So in my book, the section on physical abuse, which is corporal punishment driven, there is a section specifically on this idea of breaking the will. But the reason why I titled my book that is because I do believe, as you suggest, that it is at the heart of religious child maltreatment. And I actually dedicate the book to children who have been denied the right to question, because I feel like at the heart of religious child maltreatment, it is denying children the right to ask questions, to explore their own spiritual path, to essentially have individualism and be considered to be an important person in our society.
Isn't it more than just getting them into heaven? Isn't it also parents wanting to control the kids so the kids don't embarrass the family and they don't stray from the family values?
Right. I guess I was telling you what is professed and what is put out there. But there are, even though you have those underlying motivations, and certainly many parents do, you know, would love to control their children and not be embarrassed when they're at the grocery store and have their children act out and that kind of thing. But I do think it's also important to understand that there is a strong theological basis for these ideas.
Yeah, I was just thinking
about...
And they
are spoke of very bluntly.
Like Proverbs, you were mentioning, blueness of the wounds cleanseth away evil. And I can't remember all the stripes in the inward parts of the bellies, you know, all those awful Proverbs injunctions to beat your kids, and it's so to save their soul. Break their body, and then you will save their soul.
Exactly, and you will find books, I found two, that were written in the 70s that use that very line you're talking about to justify beating a child until there is a wound. And regardless of how one looks upon corporal punishment, I personally would never use corporal punishment on my child. But even you know, if you look at what the federal government and states are willing to say in terms of what is abusive corporal punishment, the definition is a physical wound, even if it's just a minor bruise. So essentially, these people are advocating the physical abuse of children based on what the Bible says.
Well, one of those books was probably James Dobson's book, Dare to Discipline. You probably remember that, and how parents need to be strong disciplinarians over their children. Your book identifies certain patterns or certain factors that lead to these worst abuse cases. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I felt it was necessary not just to say, well, there is abuse in faith communities and look how people harm their children, and they also happen to be religious. It really had to go beyond that. I, first of all, wanted to explain how some abuse and some neglect is actually comes about because of the beliefs of the community. Or of a child's household. Secondly, I wanted to actually differentiate what makes certain kinds of faith harmful to children and what's okay. And so I just, after reading case after case after case and taking a look at all these studies, I determined that there were three perfect storm kind of factors that made certain religious environments unhealthy. And those would be religious authoritarian cultures, as I call them. The three factors would have to be having a strict social hierarchy, having a fear-based culture, and also social separatism. And when you have those three, there's, in my view, it seems borne out in my research, that there's a stronger likelihood that there would be religious child maltreatment.
So don't most religions have a very authoritarian base? I mean, an awful lot of them would fulfill number one, but the third one, the separatism, is that sort of where you see the polygamous cult, for example?
Actually, I have found social separatism in many religions and religious communities, even if they're located in urban environments. I'll just throw one example out, which would be Jehovah's Witnesses. You can find Jehovah's Witnesses just about everywhere. You don't have to go out to a compound in West Texas to find people who believe in that faith. But like many faiths, Jehovah's Witnesses do see it necessary to not have members, have close relationships with people who are outside the faith. They do want to proselytize and they want to have those bonds. But children are often raised to be wary of anyone who is not a Jehovah's Witness. And you have, in other faiths as well, the perception that anybody who is not part of their religion is part of Satan's world or evil or somehow out to persecute them. So you really can find that social separatism in various degrees just about anywhere.
There's a verse in the Bible that says, be in the world, but not of the world.
Yes, yes. That phrase has been used by these communities. That particular phrase has been used to rationalize why there has to be that isolation.
Well, thank you for writing a very important book, Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. We are talking with its author, Janet Heimlich.
Do you have a website?
Yeah, you have a website and blog, right?
I do. Thank you. You can go to breakingtheirwill.com, and that'll present you with all kinds of information about the issue and the book.
Well, thanks again for joining us, and congratulations on your new book, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also want to thank, as always, our very talented and hardworking producer and engineer, Brian Turani, and our announcer, Buzz Kemper. If you want to hear archives, past shows, go to ffrf.org/radio, and you can sign up for the podcast.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Support Free Thought Radio's broadcasts and podcasts and what we do, our litigation, our non-litigation work to correct violations by becoming a member. And ask for a sample copy of our May issue, chock full of very good information. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.
I'm in no hurry to die.